Now, there is a lot on our plate today because we were not able to go through the final part of this morning's lecture. So we will pick up first on that. Then we'll go on to the topic of today, which is the enamel prisms. Again, a very difficult topic and something that requires your attention. And then we'll do the lab introduction, following which we will go up, and as soon as we are set up, I would like to start with group C for the small group sessions, and be followed by group D. The reason for that is that at 4 o'clock we have the big party, a name change party. So I'm not going to be late. Okay. All right, so people, when we talked about enamel formation, remember, okay people, please pay attention. Please remember that when we discussed amoebogenesis this morning, one of the outstanding differences in amoebogenesis as opposed to any other hard tissue formation is the fact that there are two phases in the development of the amoeboblast. There is a secretory phase and there is a maturation phase. And the secretory phase that you have here was the phase that was characterized by the presence of the Thoms process. This mostly, but in this view, triangular structure through which the secretory vesicles literally put their material out. Then there was, after the full width thickness of the enamel was reached, there was a moment in which the amoeboblast was in transition, and that then meant that a lot of the organelles of the secretory amoeboblast have to be removed, and you see these autophagic vacuoles where a lot of breakdown does occur. And from that point forward we go into the maturation stage, and the maturation stage is over here, and there are two alternate phases in the maturation stage. There are groups of cells at any given time that become smooth surfaced as a amoeboblast, and then there are groups of cells that become RA. And this is an alternate kind of morphology. So any given amoeboblast can go through this for a fair number of times, 20, 30 times, before the enamel is fully matured. So these are back and forth. You go from one to the other, and always it happens in groups of amoeboblasts. Now, this is the RA amoeboblast. As I said, the RA amoeboblast has a ruffled border very similar to what the osteoclast does, and for the very same reason, functionally, that it increases the surface area of the cell membrane. Now, the work on the RA and SA modulation was done in a couple of years ago, quite a couple of years by now, by two rather senior investigators in the field, Drs. Reed and Boyd. And what they did was a rather interesting set of experiments. There were two different publications, but the experiments were clearly mutually supportive. What they did, they took the incisor of a rodent, a rat incisor in this case, and as you know, a rat incisor is a continuously growing tooth, and what you therefore have is all of the stages of amoebogenesis at the apical end of that tooth. And so what they were able to do, they gave these rats calcium isotope, and then they dipped it in a emulsion, a photographic emulsion, and then literally put these teeth, the whole tooth, in the dark room for a couple of weeks. And after a couple of weeks, they literally developed the tooth. They put it through the photographic processing. And what they found was, in specific areas, they found black bands. Black band here, black band there. And these were obviously the bands where the emulsion had been exposed to the isotope. And it was clear that the isotope was that had been given at one time only, that it was only being entered into the enamel at certain areas. And so that was interesting, and there were areas over here, light bands in between, where there was no isotope taken up at all. Then what they did, they took the enamel organ of the rat, and they literally made a spread of it, and they selected out where you found smooth-bordered amyloid blast and rough-bordered amyloid blast. And what they found was that in the light bands, there were rough-bordered amyloid blast, and in the dark bands, there were smooth-bordered amyloid blast. Now, when you compare this pattern on the right with the pattern on the left, it is clear that where you have the broader bands, those are the RA amyloblast. And so they correctly determined that the isotope, the uptake of the calcium, only occurred when the cell was in its RA phase. Okay? So the maturation amyloblast, when they were in the RA phase, permitted calcium to go into the enamel, while in the SA phase, there was no calcium uptake. Here was the calcium uptake, no calcium uptake in the SA phase. Now, the question now comes, how does the calcium and the phosphate get there? And the question is one that has to be looked at. We really don't have a solid answer, but you have to understand that the calcium comes through the blood vessels and that it has to pass through the cells of the enamel organ. These are now called the accessory cells. They are part of the enamel organ. Mostly they are stellate reticulum and stratum intermedium. Most of the OEE has gone. And now it has to go through the amyloblast and it has to go again into the enamel. How does it happen? Well, in the secretory phase, actually, there are really no way for the calcium to go through in between. That it cannot go here because of these areas where you have the junctional complexes, and they're both on the apical and on the distal side. This was an error that they produced, and so we have to assume that the calcium and phosphate ions go through the cell, not in between the cells. In the period of the RA, we have junctional complexes on the apical end, and so the chances of going through here are possible on the basal end, but not here. So there is no lateral passage between the cells. So again, you have to postulate it has to go through the cell itself. And finally, when you go from RA to SA, there is a period of time in which you are going from a apical to a basal junctional complex. And so in between, you might postulate that you have passage of the calcium and phosphate between the cells. But why invent something new? The basic idea is that we can assume that calcium and phosphate are taken up through calcium channels on the basal part of the cell, on the lateral part of the cell, get into the endoplasmic reticulum, and then are moved through a calcium channel on this side with a calcium ATPase pump into the matrix. So that is the most likely thing. So the most likely path of calcium and phosphate transfer is through the cell after it has been taken up by calcium channels on the basal and the lateral surfaces. The summary of amylogenesis then is that you start, when you start at the secretory period, you remove the basal lamina, so the basal lamina is removed at this point, and during the secretory period, which is all of this here, and increasingly the thickness of the enamel increases. And then at this point, the secretory period is over, and now, very importantly, basal lamina is reapplied. So basal lamina is present between the maturation amyloblast and the enamel matrix. Now there's a repetitive modulation, and then gradually as you go on, you remove all of the amylogenins. Again, please remember, all of the amylogenins are removed. Some of the breakdown products of enamelin are removed, and of course also of the amyloblastin, and you end up with this very limited proteinaceous material. The final thing that we have to put here is, and that, then we go on to this afternoon session, is the sequence of development of enamel. The same way you had dentin that forms, you know, with these little timelines, enamel forms for a while like this, a little bit more, it starts out at the cusps and it just grows a little bit more and a little bit more. And then there comes a point when the cusp is fully developed, and now we only grow laterally alongside the surface of the tooth. That first formed enamel up to here, where all of the amyloblasts that are differentiated at the time are still active, is known as appositional enamel. After that, there are groups of enamel amyloblasts that retire at the time, and that is characterized by the fact that you get these little bumps here, and then the new group of cells continues on for a while, and then a little bump here, and that particular enamel is known as imbrocational enamel. We will come back to that tomorrow, just in a bit more detail. I just want you to see it now to understand how the sequence of enamel formation takes place. Okay, we'll just get this one, go away with this. Now we go to the enamel prisms. No, not you. Okay. Now we actually devote a separate hour to enamel prisms because it is important both for the understanding of enamel formation and also for understanding of enamel structure. Tomorrow we do the traditional enamel structure, but today we'll talk about enamel prisms. Let's start with this. This is, again, as I promised, for each new dental tissue we will do that. This is enamel composition by weight and volume. And what you're seeing here is that in the mature enamel, now remember this is mature enamel, we have mineral, oopsie-daisy, go back. Mineral, that is the hydroxyapatite, and by weight, and that is usually the number that we like to remember, is 96%. By volume, the numbers are a little bit less dramatic. The organic matrix is 1% by weight, and the rest is water. Now, the organic matrix is present, and most of the hydroxyapatite crystallites are surrounded by just a little stocking of enamelins. So enamelins sit in the enamel prisms around the hydroxyapatite, and then there are other non-amylogenins. But specifically it is amyloblastin that we recognize. And the amyloblastin is found in the sheets, in the prism sheets. So this is in the prism, and that is in the prism sheets. As we know, there is another protein, tuftalin. The tuftalin is found near the dental enamel junction and in tufts. The tufts we will come back to tomorrow. So that is the basic composition, and it is very striking to see the amount of mineral that is present in the enamel. And so when we look about enamel, it is a funny thing. It's technically it's not even a tissue, it's a product, because at this point there are no live cells associated with it anymore, and so any change in enamel is only a physicochemical change. There is no change as a result of cell activity. Okay, that's an important thing to remember. So enamel is really a product, but we like to call it a tissue, so what the heck. Now, the unit of enamel, the primary units of enamel are prisms. And prisms essentially are domains in which the crystallites are present. So crystallite, hydroxyapatite crystallite domains are called enamel prisms. Sometimes people call them rods, and so enamel rods is another term that you have to be familiar with. Okay? And if you crack open a tooth and you look at the cracked surface, most of the time the cracking occurs along, there is a fracture surface, and it usually occurs along boundaries where the prisms are. And so you can see fairly intact prisms on a cracked surface of enamel. This is a beautiful surface that you can see this way. You're seeing the surface of the enamel here, and this is the cracked surface where you can see the prisms quite nicely. The prisms run from the DEJ all the way to the outside surface. So the length of the prism is at least the thickness of the enamel where it is located. Some many years ago, somebody did a study with literally just focusing up and down through a thick ground section, and at every level of focus he made an outline of a couple of enamel prisms, and so within a given section he got a reconstruction of that segment of the enamel prism, and it looks like this. Now if you notice it, the enamel prism is not smooth, it's not a tubular structure, it has kind of little contractions and little widenings, and that is something that you can see here. You can see little areas where you see little bumps, and then there are areas where you see little depressions. 4 micrometers apart, what does it tell you? Okay, the 4 micrometer dimension, people. We saw it in dentin. Haven't studied dentin yet. Okay. 24 hours. Okay. Diurnal pattern. All right. So the lengths of enamel prism vary with their location in crown. Get very short when they are in the cervical area. The diameters of the enamel prisms generally are something of 4 to 5 micrometers, although there is variation about that. And each set of prisms is separated from an adjacent set by a prism sheet. And the prism sheet is 0.1 to 0.2 micrometers. It looks wider in most of our tissues, and that's because it kind of reflects the light in a funny sort of way. But it's only about 0.1 to 0.2 micrometers. Yo!
The diurnal pattern is caused by the collagen, right? You see darker and lighter because of the collagen. In enamel, do you see any differences between day and night?
It is not just collagen, my friend. It's also the mineralization. And that's big time in enamel. Okay? Yeah. Okay. Now, here's some really lovely pictures. They are showing in 2 individuals... the difference between upper and lower molars, permanent molars, as far as the thickness is concerned. This is individual 1, this is individual 2. This is on the left side is the maxillary molar, on the right side is the mandibular molar. And if you look closely, you can see that the 4 surfaces of the molar are indicated. Lingual on the top, buccal on the bottom, distal and medial. What is important to notice here is that the maxillary molars tend to have thicker enamel on the lingual side, while the mandibular molars tend to have thicker enamel on the buccal side. That is an interesting finding, which, cause and effect, I'm not 100% sure. In this, the individual on top, it is a little bit more dramatic than in the individual on the bottom. But now when you look at the dimensions, you can see that when you are in the red area, you're running about 1 to 2 millimeters, 1.5 to 2 millimeters rather. And that is the thickest part of the enamel. Now that is therefore the minimal dimension of the length of of the enamel prism in that area. As we will see, the enamel prism is in fact not running straight, but it's running in curves, and so it is actually somewhat longer. But that's an idea. The length of the enamel prism, therefore, can be measured in millimeters. Okay. Now, how does the diameter of the enamel prism look, and how are enamel prisms related to each other? Human patterns, and I'm now specifically indicating human patterns, can vary from horseshoe-shaped to arcades to keyholes. And they're all variations on a theme. If you look at this, there is always a shift like this. So this alternate rows, prisms are always aligned, but in the next row they are always a little bit off. And this is the same thing here. Okay, so no matter what pattern you have, they are not, the prisms are not lined up in rows very nicely, or columns. They are not columns is the word. They're not lined up neatly in columns. They are kind of having little shifts, and so there's an alternating pattern. The outline of the prisms can vary from horseshoe to arcades to keyholes, but for our purposes, we have settled on the keyhole pattern. The keyhole pattern is identified in this particular diagram. It is the ideal pattern of a human enamel prism. And what you find here is, this is the keyhole. And you find that you can describe human enamel as an interlocking pattern of prisms that are keyhole shaped in cross section. Okay, it's a mouthful. But pay attention to it, because that is how we describe it. And so when you make a cut like this, what you can have is a white part, that is the white part of the keyhole, and that is alternating with a narrow part, that is, sorry, this is not a good one, this is the narrow part, this is the white part, here's the narrow, here's the white part again, this is the narrow part again, and white. So what you find is that enamel prisms are really best described this way. Now, they were described at the shows where I am, when I was in the final year of dental school, and they described the box model. And the box model was developed by a bunch of guys. Hey, I know that name, Meckel. Not Meckel's cartilage, this is a young nephew of Meckel. But anyway, he's part of the family though. He was working in a commercial firm, and they were doing wonderful research, and one day they decided, gee, they didn't understand the way enamel looked in different sections, and so they tried to figure it out. And they figured it out, and they produced the also famous box model. Now the box model has been reproduced by everybody under the son, including myself, and we have all been given permission, and it was all very nice. They're very, very nice people, really. And what you see here is a block out of enamel. And now, let's try to understand it, because enamel prisms do look different in different sections. This is the surface, the front surface, where the enamel prisms are cut in cross section. Then that is the surface that is parallel to the outside surface, and, you know, for simplicity's sake, also parallel to the DEJ. We know that's not 100% so, but let's be. So that is the surface where we see the cross sections enamel prisms. We are now talking about the surface of the tooth on the buccal side. And now when you look at this view, this particular surface, that is a longitudinal section, and in this case the cusps or the incisal edges are on the top and these on the bottom. And then this surface here, but also the prisms are longitudinally sectioned. And these are cross-section prisms on the front surface. And finally, the top surface here is a transverse section through the tooth, and it is a longitudinal section through the prisms. And based on the orientation of the hydroxyapatite crystallized that you're seeing here, you can say that this surface faces the outside of the tooth. That's something that I will make clear to you in a moment. Okay, so what you're seeing here now is a series of crystallite domains. And so inside each domain, you have crystallites running, and you can see that in the white part of the keyhole, the crystallites are running parallel to the long axis of the prism, while they then bend around over here, and in the narrow part of the keyhole, they are running perpendicular to the long axis of the prism. So in two parts of the keyhole, the crystallites are running almost perpendicular to each other. Okay? Now, what does that mean? Let you see this. Yeah. Here it is. These are from the very fine book that Dr. Kleibert and I wrote. And what you're seeing here is, again, a very elegant picture of the keyhole-shaped outlines of enamel prisms. And now what we say is, okay, let's look at the enamel prism and see it in three dimensions. And essentially what we have done here is we have taken an enamel prism, removed a very large part in between, sort of saying, well, you know, enamel prisms are in the neighborhood of millimeters worth of length, so this, we cannot show the whole thing. And now what we have done is that indicate inside that prism the orientation of the hydroxyapatite crystallites. So again, parallel in the round end, and in the bottom end, the tail end, they're running at right angles. And this now again shows the same thing in a graphic situation: cross-sectioned hydroxyapatite crystallites in the top, and longitudinally visible crystallites in the bottom part of the prism. How is that possible? Well, it's possible because the crystallites are laid down in the enamel matrix at right angles to the surface of the ameloblast. In other words, if you have a surface of the ameloblast here, the crystallites are being laid down in the enamel at right angles to that. If the surface bends around, the crystallites are going to run like this. Okay? But that's the trick, really. It is therefore a reflection of the surface of the ameloblast that was involved in the elaboration of that enamel. Now, there are, in fact, people who call the white part of the prism the actual prism, and the narrow part of that keyhole of the prism interprismatic substance. How does that work? Well, it has to do with the various mammalian prism patterns. And the various mammalian prism patterns were described really for the first time by a good colleague of ours, Alan Boyd, dentist. He also did a PhD in anatomy. And in 1964, when this rascal did his PhD, he described mammalian prism patterns, and they have held up all these years. And we all think that's pretty darn good. You know, if you write a PhD and people still quote it 40 years later, that's pretty good. And so what he described is different animals have really different prism patterns. And for example, a cat and a dog have a prism that is essentially round, completely surrounded by a prism sheath. So the prism sheath is here. The prism is inside here. And what's all the stuff in between? That's known as interprismatic substance. Yes. That's pattern one. Pattern two is a slight variation of that, but now the prism sheet is not entirely surrounding the prism. What you have, in fact, is a situation where the prism sheet only goes this much. Okay? And the next prism, and the next prism. And so what you find is that the prisms are lined up in this kind of a nice, neat column. And again, in between, there's something else. So we call this prism, and this prism sheath, although it is incomplete, and this here is in the prismatic substance. And now we get pattern 3, and pattern 3 is the basic human pattern. Now, we have again an incomplete prism sheath, and an incomplete prism sheath, but we don't have the prisms neatly lined up in columns with interprismatic substance in between. We have this interlocking situation. So, can you call this interprismatic substance? Sure you can. So interprismatic substance is what people call, many people call this. This is called a prism and this is a prism sheath. Understand? Very easy. So when people describing human enamel talk about interprismatic substance, they talk about the tail of the prism. And why do I say it's the tail of the prism? Because it's the same material, the same hydroxyapatite crystallites. It is no difference. You can go from the head of the prism to the tail of the prism, and it's all the same. There is no distinct boundary between the two. In this case here, there are distinct boundaries. You can claim distinct boundaries here because you have distinct areas. But essentially, that is the reason why you can either call the whole thing a prism, and you say there's interlocking prisms, or you can talk about interprismatic substance. Either one is fine by me, okay? It really doesn't matter. Whatever you prefer to talk about, as long as you know what I'm talking about, no problem. Okay. The left side of the diagram shows you actually the outline, hexagonal outline, of one single ameloblast. And if you look at how the ameloblast's outline and the prism outline are superimposed, you notice that for each prism there is essentially one ameloblast. Okay? One ameloblast per prism. In the case of the humans, it's slightly more complicated because one ameloblast in humans will contribute to four prisms. And each prism is formed by four ameloblasts, but it's still one ameloblast per prism. Okay, let me just show you a type 2 prism pattern. Happens to be in pink. And what you're seeing here is here are the prisms, and here is the interprismatic substance. See, and you can see this little row of prisms, and then interprismatic substance. Another row of prisms, interprismatic substance. Here it is in section. Here are the prisms. And here is the interprismatic substance. Okay? Now, what is the problem with this? If the pig enamel is subjected to certain shear loads, it very easily gives way. It easily fractures. It easily is disturbed. Human enamel is pretty solid. It stands up to loading very well. And so that is the advantage of the interlocking keyholes. Now let's look at the shape of the human ameloblast as we have figured it out. Here is the human ameloblast, and what you're seeing here is the body of the human ameloblast. At this point here would be the area of the apical terminal web, and the junctional complexes. And now there is a little shoulder. This is a shoulder, and then a little bit further in, there is the Thoms process. And based on the shape of the human prisms, the Thoms process can be thought of as a structure that looks like this. It has kind of one sloping surface, and that is concave, and then it has a convex outer surface. This concave surface and the shoulder are the secretory areas of the Thoms process, of the ameloblast. So this here and this here, that is the secretory surface. This part of the Thoms process, this concave surface area, is going to give rise to the head of the prism. It's clear. You look at the shape, it makes good sense. While the shoulder is giving rise to the various tail ends of adjacent prisms. Okay, so if this is the shoulder gives rise to this adjacent tail end of this prism, and this adjacent tail end, this adjacent tail end of an adjacent prism and another tail end of the prism above. Okay, so they're very busy cells, those ameloblasts. Now here are some examples of that. You see here the imprints of two sets of Thoms processes. This is a set of Thoms processes that have left their imprint behind in the enamel matrix and producing a pattern 1, where you have forming an enamel prism and an interprismatic substance here. In the case over here, you have pattern 3. You have this sloping surface, and you get a kind of a keyhole-like arrangement. Now, how do Thoms processes look? Thoms processes can look like triangles suspended from the cell, and that is when you are making a cut like this, in this direction. When you make that cut, you go from one surface, and then you get to the deep point, and then it bends around and goes around. This is the shoulder, and then again you go to the next one here, and you make another one. So that is one kind of cut to make, and that's how you see Thoms processes. So there will be triangles in this case. If, on the other hand, you cut in this direction, you can get this kind of pattern. Box-like pattern. Now here you clearly see the shoulder area, right? That is the shoulder. So depending on how you cut, the Thoms process can look differently. And in this case here, the secretory surface is here, and again here over in the shoulder area, and then again over here in the flat area. And the back resorptive surface is on the sides. Over here the secretory surface is in this direction, this direction, this direction, all the way, and then back resorption here. Here again, secretory surface. Get the general idea? So even in the Thoms process, which is really in the prime example of a secretory ameloblast, do you find secretion, but you also find back resorption. Remember, this cell produced not only proteins, but it also produced proteinases. The enamelysin or MMP20 and calicrein 4, these are proteinases that break down the proteins almost the moment they are arriving in the matrix, and because of that, when they break it down, part of these breakdown products go right back in. So the Thoms process really serves two functions, both a secretory and a back resorptive function. And here's another interesting part about Thoms processes. Thoms processes determine the actual morphology of the prisms. This is incredibly interesting. The reason why you can say that is because we know that the hydroxyapatite crystallites form at right angles to the cell membrane of the ameloblast. And so when the cell membranes of the ameloblasts are smooth and don't have a Thoms process, what you find is you find enamel matrix being deposited, and you find a generalized series of hydroxyapatite crystallites without any pattern. They just are lying nicely parallel in the matrix. However, the moment you start having Thoms processes, depending on the shape, you can get different kinds of arrangements. This is a pseudo-prismatic situation, but there are in fact prisms here. And this here, now it begins to look more like what we know. This is in fact an enamel prism. And so depending on the Thoms processes, depending on the shape, the prisms are being shaped in that way, according to it. Now this is a very interesting and important point for you clinically, because this morning I indicated to you that at the beginning of the secretory phase you frequently do not have a Thoms process yet, it kind of gradually develops, and toward the end of the secretory phase you may lose the Thoms process. And when that happens, you no longer have enamel prisms. And so in this particular case here, what you're seeing is a situation where from here to here, this area, below it there are prisms, all right, but above it, this area has no prisms. This is known as prismless or aprismatic enamel. And that is found very frequently near the DEJ and also very frequently near the surface of enamel. So depending on whether you had or did not have Thoms processes, you may find little patches of prismless enamel. How does that involve you clinically? Well, if you are going to do some interesting tricks with bonding, and you're going to prime the surface by doing a little demineralizing to kind of etch it very nicely up, prismless enamel really doesn't etch very well. It just kind of disappears a little bit. So you remove a little layer, and it's still smooth. Okay. So if you do an etching of enamel to get a little bit more relief of the surface structures, in the case of prismless enamel, it doesn't work. So you always have to be aware of that. You have to be aware that it can be a little bit of prismless enamel. It's not a lot. It can be 100 micrometers max. Okay. Yes. You cannot tell the difference when you look at it clinically. No, no. Sorry about that. That's it looks perfectly fine. Actually, it looks very smooth. Okay.
Another question.
Yeah.
Does the prismless enamel just normally wear away with attrition anyway?
Yeah, sure. Eventually.
But is it over decades or?
It depends where it is. Okay. It depends where it is. If it is in an area where you have some wear, no problem. It will disappear. But in some areas, it will not. So it really depends. Now, what I have done in your chapter, I have included this little thing. It is something that a young, now not so young anymore, colleague once produced, Lumsden, and essentially he tried to make sense of all of these various phases of enamel and of ameloblast, and tried to put it all together in one little box. He was making his own little box. And essentially, what he did, he produced this, and now you can make folds around this end, and you can make folds around this end, and you can make a fold here, and then you can, and a fold here also, right? Okay, fine. And what you can do then is to fold it up and tuck the edges all together, and you can actually make yourself a three-dimensional model and look at all these various orientations of the prisms, the hydroxyapatite crystallites inside the prisms, and the relationship of the cells relative to the prisms. So that is kind of cute, it really is, and you know, it helps you to get a three-dimensional feeling. So if you want to do that, you can make a copy, an extra copy of it, and cut it up and stick it together, okay? Every now and then somebody gets it. Huh? There you go. Well, so you're well prepared for it, what can I say? This is really, I tell you, to understand enamel, you have to do a bit of three-dimensional thinking. And this is very critical. So I suggest that you play around with it and do that. Okay, let's talk briefly about the course of the enamel prisms. Enamel prisms, as a general rule, which stands up clinically very nicely, runs perpendicular to the tangent to the surface. If this is the tangent to the surface, the prisms run perpendicular to it. And so you know that when you are cutting into enamel, you kind of have a general idea about the orientation of the prisms. And depending on where you are, these prisms can look fairly straight, and as they are in this particular figure here. However, there are curved prism pads. And the prism pads become curved. What they are shown here is it's basically unfair because they are not really visible as curved pads in a longitudinal section. They are really visible as curved pads in a transverse section. And so what we are going to have to do, this is the normal thing, perpendicular to the tangent of the surface. Think of a wheel the spokes of a wheel perpendicular to the tangent of the surface of that wheel. That's essentially how prisms run, so it's very straightforward. But now let's look at how the prisms run. And the prisms in any horizontal plane, and you therefore see that best in the transverse section of a tube, are actually not running straight. If they were running straight, they would go from the DEJ out in this direction, as the ameloblasts were moving in this direction. But the ameloblasts don't do it. The ameloblasts, in fact, go for a little while straight, and then they can go either this way, actually they go more like this, or they can go this way. And so there are, in fact, different paths that the ameloblasts take at different vertical levels. In any given vertical level, the ameloblasts tend to run in the same direction. But at the next vertical level, the ameloblast may run in an opposite direction. And so what you find is that they are not, the prisms are not straight, they are curved, and they may have this kind of arrangement. And depending on where you are, in what particular plane, this is now a vertical dimension, and so you can say that in this first plane, a prism may run in this way, and the next plane is it may slightly out of phase, going a little bit further out like this, and then here it goes a little bit further out like this. You get the general point. And then after a while, it recurves and goes the opposite way. So these are curves that were made after computer modeling, and that's what you say, at so many control points, and you fit the curves, and you get these little prism curvatures, and it's just very beautifully done piece of work. But I liked it because it shows very beautifully how along these vertical dimensions, at any given plane, the prisms may have a slightly different run. And so, different in different teeth, there are different curvatures, there are different frequencies, there are different amplitudes. As you know, this would be the amplitude and the frequencies. You can have a couple, or you can have even more than this, or you can just have one very slow curve. You know, so there are any number of them, and that's what you find in teeth. And so in each horizontal plane, you will see the curvatures of the enamel prisms. And as a result, let me just go back to, if I were to make a cut, a vertical cut, that's hard to do here, okay, forget it. If I were to make a vertical cut through enamel, I find some areas where the prisms are running more longitudinally sections, and then there are bands where the prisms run in cross sections, and then there are again bands where they run longitudinally, and then they can run cross sections, and so on. At higher magnification, you can see that better. They are not entirely longitudinal, they are not entirely in cross section, but there are these alternating bands. Those bands, and you might as well hit you with it now because it will come back tomorrow with a vengeance, are known as Hunter-Schrager bands, or H&S bands. Okay? Now, Hunter-Schrager bands are bands of prisms that are alternatingly cut in a longitudinal fashion, a cross-sectional fashion, and that is as a result of these curvatures of the prism which are going in opposite directions at different vertical levels. This then is a section that I made once, and it shows it also very nicely. Here, one band, second band, third band. So there are longitudinally cut, cross-section, longitudinally cut, cross-section. You get the point. These are bands of prisms that are cut in different ways because they are running in different directions at different vertical levels. Okay, I think now is a moment to break, and then we go on to the laboratory.